Well, I invite you to open your Bibles to Mark chapter 13. This is our next to last message in this series in Mark 13. We'll have one more after we get back from our time in New Jersey. But we're looking today at verses 24 through 31, focusing on the promise of His coming. One little girl was heard in her Sunday school class about the promise of Jesus coming again. She was listening with great interest to what the teacher said and taking it all in. And then she went and saw her mom afterwards and asked her mom, "Mommy, do you believe that Jesus is coming back and that it could be soon?" The mom replied, "Yes, dear, I really do believe that." The little girl paused and thought, "Mom, would you please comb my hair?" She wanted to look good. She wanted to be ready in case Jesus came back at that moment. That's pretty practical response, pretty immediate response to a doctrine that the Bible teaches in many ways, the impending, the imminent promise of His return. That theme is very clear, and that theme has been carrying through this chapter as we've been working our way through it. I pointed out before, and you have heard in my struggles in interpreting and understanding some parts of this chapter, that chapter 13 of Mark is one of the most, it's probably the most debated or disputed chapter in terms of the proper interpretation of exactly what Jesus is saying here. And in fact, we have evangelical believers that come to very different conclusions about it. You know, if we were to draw a graph, you know, we would have men as respected as R.C. Sproul on one end of the line over here, saying that most everything in this chapter in some way found its fulfillment in A.D. 70, in the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the Jewish age, he would say. And then you have others on the other end of the spectrum, as we've been listening in Sunday school to Dr. David Jeremiah, who would point most of this into the distant future, talking about the final tribulation and the promise of the return of Christ. I've probably disappointed some of you by taking kind of a mediating position, saying that this is an example of prophetic perspective. Jesus is talking like an Old Testament prophet. He's looking at an event that is near, that will be a confirmation to his disciples and others who hear this prophecy that of who He is, that He is predicting, yes, the destruction of the temple. Remember, that's where it started in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 13. Jesus said, "Not one stone would be left upon another." They get to the Mount of Olives and the disciples ask Him, "When is this going to happen? When will all of this be fulfilled?" And we know from His answer and from Matthew's gospel that gives us the fuller question that the disciples ask. They also had two other parts to that question. "And what is the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" So Jesus is telling them about something that's going to happen soon, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. But He also interweaves with that teaching about the promise of His second coming. The disciples probably thought of those things as being simultaneous. That when the temple is destroyed, that's the end of the age. That means the next thing is the Messiah ruling in power and defeating the nations, defeating the enemy, establishing his kingdom on earth. And they're probably still seeing those things as coming together, but Jesus is talking about two things. One, in the near term, maybe 40 years or so after He's speaking here, and one in the distant future, which we are still looking and waiting and expecting for, and that is the promise of His return. The context that we've been looking is for our fourth week now in this chapter 13, working our way through it. We've seen in this discourse the call to stay faithful, because life will get hard, but Jesus is coming. We've been encouraged that the assurance of God's presence and the certainty of victory will enable us to endure both the trials of life and the attacks of the enemy. And we've also seen that we can be assured that God is in control and that His word will guide us through difficult and deceptive times. This week, as we get to these verses, chapter 13, 24 through 31, the main idea, you have it there in your bulletin, we'll see that Jesus is coming soon to gather his people to himself. The question for each of us is, are you ready? Are you waiting? Are you expecting his return? So that's the first point. Jesus is coming. He will come again to gather his people. In some preceding context, he's been describing days of tribulation, as well as an example of intense tribulation that would happen at the time of the siege of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. And I believe in that, as he mentions the abomination of desolation, he's also looking ahead to a future tribulation that will come at the end of the age and in connection with his second coming. He's not giving us a detailed timeline. He's talking in generalities. He's making the point that you're going to experience tribulation. He'll say the same thing to the disciples in the upper room. In this world, you will have tribulation. He says in that chapter, don't be surprised if the world hates you. Remember, it hated me first. So we see that kind of idea that these kinds of things, wars and rumors of wars, famines and pestilence, even natural disasters like earthquakes, are going to happen throughout the age. This is part of living in the fallen world, but he describes it as birth pangs. And as birth pangs get more intensify before the birth, I believe we can draw from that analogy the idea that there will be a time of intense tribulation, many refer to as the Great Tribulation, at the end of the age. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Well, first we see here this initial statement that Jesus makes in verse 24. But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. We see him talking about these cosmic events. The sun darkened, the moon not giving its light, the stars falling from the sky, heavenly bodies being shaken. A prophecy that these cosmic signs would unfold. We probably shouldn't be surprised about that. When we realize what happened in the fall of man, we probably should expect something like this, some shaking of the cosmos related to what Jesus is doing and when he comes to establish his kingdom on earth. Remember what happened. Jesus... When Adam and Eve in the garden sinned, God spoke to them. They were cursed. They would experience death, experience spiritual death and physical death ultimately. Unless they put their trust in him, they could be delivered spiritually. But they began to decay at that moment. But the ground was also cursed. The universe was cursed. Paul talks a little bit about that reality in that great 8th chapter of the book of Romans, verses 19 through 22. Let me read a couple of verses there describing the state of creation longing for the return of the Lord. Verse 19, the creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed, for the creation was subjected to frustration. Not by its own choice, but by the will of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. That's interesting. We see that language of birth pains in our passage here in Mark 13, and we see it there also in Romans chapter 8 as he's describing the birth pains that creation is experiencing. Creation has fallen. And we shouldn't be surprised that we see at the end of the age signs in the creation that it's being shaken by the return of Jesus, the Messiah, the Judge, the Redeemer. We see that imagery in the prophets that Jesus is referring to the prophet Isaiah, I think, here in this language that he uses. Let me read a few verses from Isaiah chapter 13, verses 9 to 13. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger to make land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. That sounds familiar. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and humble the pride of the ruthless. I will make man scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of His burning anger. Wow. Now, is that all poetic imagery? I think we see some language like that elsewhere in the prophets that make us believe that there will be those signs in the cosmos when Jesus returns, the sun's not giving its light, the moon being darkened. Ezekiel, again, talks about a coming day of judgment when he says in chapter 32, verses 7 through 8, I will snuff you out. I will cover the heavens and darken their stars. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light. All the shining lights in the heaven I will darken over you. I will bring darkness over your land, declares the sovereign Lord. And Joel makes a similar statement when he says in Joel 2:10, before the earth shakes, the sky trembles, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars no longer shine. Later in that chapter, by the way, in Joel chapter 2, there's a shift toward hope and salvation. We're reminded that judgment is coming, and the prophets seem heavy on that, calling the people to recognize that their unbelief and their failure to obey God and to walk in obedience to the covenant is going to bring God's wrath and judgment on the world and upon the nation. Joel chapter 2 also goes on to promise to give hope. Verse 28 through 32. This might sound familiar because it's quoted by the apostles by Peter in Acts chapter 2 in part. Let me read a couple of verses from Joel 2:28. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. Even on the male and female servants in those days I will pour out my spirit, and I will make show wonders in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and columns of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those who escape, as the Lord has said, and among the survivors shall be those whom the Lord calls. A little further on in his prophecy, Joel offers the prophecy of judgment, the prospect of hope, but he also calls for decision. He said, let the nations be roused. You see that in this passage. Wake up, right? Stay awake. Be attentive. Here he says, let the nations be roused. Let them advance into the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the nations on every side. Swing the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, trample the grapes, for the winepress is full and the vats overflow. So great is their wickedness. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon will be darkened. It's the language we see here. The sun and the moon will be darkened, and the stars no longer shine. The Lord will roar from Zion and thunder from Jerusalem, and earth and sky will tremble. But the Lord will be a refuge for his people, a stronghold. What a picture. Judgment coming, the universe being shaken, but the prospect of hope, of deliverance, of salvation, a call for decision. Respond to him while it's still day, while there's still time. You see a lot in these verses. Nations judge, multitudes in the valley of decision. God's present kingdom blessings being poured out on his people. And here in Mark, Jesus is using that same language when he talks about the sun being darkened, the moon not giving its light, the stars falling from heaven, the powers of the heavens being shaken. Verse 26, he says, "And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory." Jesus will quote from that prophet Daniel, as he does allude to him here when he stands before the priests and the others who are judging him, asking him about who he is. He'll talk about the coming of the Son of Man on clouds of glory, coming with power. That's what he's saying here. "At that time you will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. And he will send his angels and gather his elect from the four winds and from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." So we see that this idea of deliverance for those who are the elect, those who are believing in him, being taken out of the world before that judgment is poured out on the earth. I don't think from what Jesus is saying here that he intends for us to work out a precise timetable. I love those things, by the way. One of my study Bibles has a very nice timetable of exactly how everything is going to unfold at the end of the age. And I think we need to study that and be as precise as we possibly can. But we need to keep the main things the main things, right? We need to be sure of what the Bible says clearly, and that is to be ready, to be expecting his return. That's the main idea here, that Jesus is returning. He's coming soon to gather his people to himself. And the question that every human has to ask, are you ready? Do you recognize that's true? Little girl hears that story about Jesus coming back, and she says, "I better get ready. Mommy, will you comb my hair?" She wants to look good when Jesus comes, right? And we need to be ready. We need to realize our lives that we're living now in this fallen world, it's not just for here and now. Whether we live a short life or whether we live 90 or 100 years or whatever it might be, that's only a speck of time compared to eternity. We've been created for eternity. And he has us here on assignment because the people all around us are in the valley of decision, that they have to recognize their need. Our lesson this week for the Word of Life kids was on the fact that there's none righteous, not even one. And in hearing that, and hearing the lesson about sin, the message of salvation, two children responded, right? They recognized, hey, wait a minute. I need to make sure that my sins are forgiven, that I trust Jesus as my Savior. That's why he came. We've been asking those questions all the way through Mark. Well, Mark has been answering them for us, actually. Who is Jesus? This is God incarnate who came into this world. And why did he come? He came for a purpose. He came to make it possible for sinful humans to be reconciled to holy God. That is incredibly good news. God didn't simply send judgment because of our sin, but he sent a Redeemer who took judgment. Our sin was laid upon him. All we like sheep have gone astray. Every one of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has laid on him, on Jesus, the iniquity of us all. If your trust is in Him, that means you're forgiven. That means you're declared righteous. Not because you're good, but because the righteousness of Christ has been reckoned to your account. He took your sin. You receive His righteousness. That is truly amazing grace. I'm going off script here, so to speak, but in that lesson today in Sunday school, the video of Dr. David Jeremiah, he used the example of his own lymphoma that he suffered with. And he said something like, could you imagine that I went to the doctor with my symptoms, headaches, pain in my body, whatever it was, and I went there to the doctor, and he just looked me over. He knew what was wrong with me, but he simply said, no, it's all in your head. You'll be okay. Just go your own way. I mean, he knew what my problem was, but he didn't tell me. And he knew what the cure was, but he didn't tell me. That would be a horrible, horrible injustice, right? Malpractice of the worst kind. We don't want to be guilty of spiritual malpractice, do we? Because God has put each one of us exactly where we are. He has put people in our sphere of influence who need to know that truth, that they're not okay. It's not I'm okay, you're okay. That unless their trust is in Jesus, they're headed toward a lost eternity. And you might be the only person in their sphere of influence who knows the cure to the disease that they're suffering with. The disease is sin. The end is death. And Jesus is the cure. They need to trust Him. We have that good news. And let's seize the opportunities that he gives us. Because time is short. We don't know how long anyone is going to live. Our neighbors, our friends, our relatives, ourselves. And we don't know when Jesus is returning. Right? So one way or the other, time is short. So we need to seize the opportunities while it's still day. We need to be ready because He is coming soon. That's what this passage is talking about. And I think the implication of that, because He's coming and it's imminent, we should be expecting, we should be looking up. It could be at any moment. We need to be ready. We see that in this parable of this illustration of the fig tree in verses 28 through 31. Now learn the lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that it is near, right at the door. So he's making a prediction of his imminent return. Now, a little earlier in the chapter, or a little earlier in Mark, I think it's before chapter 12, I think, we see the fig tree being used by Jesus as he curses the fig tree, then the cleansing of the temple, and they come back to the fig tree and they see that it's withered. So in that context of the judgment of Israel, we see the fig tree, the cursing of the fig tree, and that drives some people to carry that idea through to this illustration, that the fig tree must be referring to Israel, and perhaps the twigs getting tender, the leaves coming out, might be the restoration of Israel as a state. It might be an indication that his return is near. Maybe, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm ready to push that interpretation here. I think one thing that we can say for sure, the main thing I think that's being pictured here, is that he's using an example from nature, an illustration, to show that there's going to be tribulation in the world. He just talked about an example of intense tribulation. And as we see the fall of Jerusalem, as we see these things happening in the world, these things are reminders to us that it's not that everything is okay in the world. We live in a fallen world. I've thought about that a lot lately. When I hear these reports on the news, the horrible things that happen in Pittsburgh at a synagogue, you know, what kind of human depravity leads somebody to do something like that? You know, when we hear about sickness and suffering of people, when we hear about people who are being persecuted for faith in countries like Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, when we hear about natural disasters like earthquakes taking dozens or hundreds or thousands of lives, you think of all of the evil and the suffering and the pain in the world. All of that is a reminder that we live in a fallen world. And guess what? God didn't create it that way. He created a world that was good. Human sin brought death and suffering and the curse on creation. Jesus came to pay the price so that we could be reconciled to God and so that one day creation can be restored. Our hope is in a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And God will restore creation to what He intended it, to be. These things are signs that should be reminding us every day as we live here where we have been placed. It should be reminding us that all is not right in the world. The world is fallen. And guess what? Jesus is coming again. That the time is short. And so we need to be ready. We need to be expectant. We should live differently because that's true. One of the great passages of practical application with respect to the promise of His coming for me has been Titus chapter 2. Paul is writing to a young disciple in that chapter when he says in Titus 2:11, "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave Himself for us that He might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for Himself His own special people, zealous for good works." Teaching us that, verse 12, denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live differently. We should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. The promise of His return is a motivation to live differently, to make choices that honor the King, to comb our hair, recognizing that He is returning, right? So we want to be ready. And here we see a promise that His word is sure. He says, this is in a sense the crux of the passage, is verse 30 when he says, "I tell you the truth, this generation will not pass away until all these things have happened." Now that's really where the big division between R.C. Sproul and Dr. David Jeremiah comes from. That verse, this generation, does that mean by all things, does that mean the promise of His return as well? I think the mediating position that makes the most sense to me is that He is pointing to the signs. When will all these things take place? The disciples ask. They're asking with that word, that phrase, all things, about the destruction of the temple that Jesus had predicted. Later he talks of these things. When he talks about these things that are happening, he's talking about the suffering and the earthquakes and the kinds of things that we'll see as we live our life in a fallen world. These are signs that He is near. I like what Alistair Begg said. He said, "If He's near, He can't be here." In other words, it's not a sign that He's come. It's a reminder that He is coming. And that reminder should call us, should move us, should motivate us to be ready, to living with expectation, to looking for His return. This generation, I think he's referring to that generation right there that he was speaking to. There's another possibility that he might be talking about the Jewish people, since the word there, generation, can also mean a race or a nation. But I don't think so. The context seems to be that he's talking to his disciples and saying that those alive right now are going to see these things. Well, what things? They're going to see the signs of his coming. They're going to see the indication that we live in a fallen world that remind us that he will come again ultimately, and he will set all things right. He will make all things new. He'll restore creation for what it was intended to be. I read that passage a few minutes ago from Joel chapter 3, where it calls for a decision. It said, "Let the nations be roused." That mission has been entrusted to us. Right? We've been called to go into the world and to preach the gospel to all the nations. Right? So it's a call to be diligent, to be alert, to be engaged. And why is it so urgent? For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. I think that's the practical application of this big term, eschatology, the study of the last days, because we're living in the last days. And that means in every age, at every moment, the church has been called to be ready and to be engaged in the mission, to with a sense of urgency, take the message of hope and life to the people that we interact with. In our Wednesday night Bible study, we look at the study questions that you have on the back of the bulletin and talk about some of that. Last week, one of the things that we asked about is, if you knew that Jesus was coming soon, I forgot what the timetable was, in 6 months or something like that, how would that impact the way that you live? And I think all of us said, well, it would sure add to the urgency that we would want to make sure that the people around us, the people we care about, the people we interact with, to make sure that they know the message, to urge them on behalf of Christ to be reconciled to God. Well, guess what? It could be that soon, or it could be sooner. So we have to seize the opportunities that he has given us. The nations are in the valley of decision. Jesus is coming. Unbelief will be judged. And he's coming to offer deliverance. Or he has come to offer deliverance and life if we'll put our trust in him. That's the message that we bring to the people around us. He said, "I'm come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly." The promise is that whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. As we consider this passage, we recognize who Jesus is and why he came. We should seize the calling to follow him, to be obedient, and to be the witness that he intends us to be. It's a fitting thing when we consider the intent of the Lord's table, which is a look back at the cross, to look back at the provision that he made, to consider that the language is used in Scripture that as we celebrate that ordinance that we've been given, we show forth the Lord's death until he comes. We show forth the Lord's death. It's a one more reminder of why we're here. It's one more reminder of what he did. It's one more motivation to stay faithful and proclaim that message, knowing that he will return. Let's look to him together in prayer.